Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Cache Lake Country, or Life in the North Woods, by John J. Rowlands, narrated by Keith Sellenwright. Introduction. My father came of age in 1947, that unusual year when he was a very young bandleader in a small Iowa town. That year, he began collecting the books he has come to call, by convention, the library, as if it were a Turkish carpeted chamber with a dinner gong and a superannuated attendant, instead of a wall in the hall where we keep the books. The library was, and still is, a ragtag collection. It includes my mother's nursing texts, limp and alarming, an enormous variety of do-it-yourself volumes, and a few books, circa 1947, which must have been acquired by my father and mother with the trepidation all young book buyers feel. If you are not accustomed to spending money on books, the weight of choosing just one from the whole world of letters, especially in a time before paperbacks became popular, is almost too much to bear. Cache Lake Country, which was published in that year, 1947, may have been the first real book my dad ever bought. By real, I mean that it was not an assigned college text, but had been purchased out of simple desire to own a book for itself. By real, I also mean that it cost $4, plenty at the time, and came with a dust jacket and illustrations. But if Cache Lake Country was the first real book my dad ever bought, it was an amazing choice, because it is also the best book ever written. So I thought when I first found it in the library and read it as a boy. So I have thought upon rereading it every year since. So I think now, having just closed its covers again. Cache Lake Country is one of two books, Spindrift is the other, written by John J. Rowlands. Nothing in Cache Lake Country will tell you that when he wrote it, it began as a Cache Lake letter distributed to friends. Rowlands was the public relations officer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You would never guess that he had been a widely respected journalist with the United Press Association in New York and Boston, or that he had been the first person to reach Vice President Calvin Coolidge in Vermont with the news that President Warren G. Harding had died. What you learn about Rowlands in Cache Lake Country is far more vital and concerns an earlier era, the years in the early part of this century when Rowlands worked as a miner, prospector, surveyor, and timber cruiser in northern Ontario, just south of Hudson Bay. It is as a timber scout that he chooses to appear in Cache Lake Country. One September dawn, working his canoe up a chain of lakes and streams, he paddled into the middle of an unknown lake and stopped to rest, like a fellow will do when he sees new water for the first time. But this was old water, too, for as he sat there, motionless in his canoe, Rowlands felt it all come back to him. As the sun cleared the hills and turned the black water into shining gold, I remembered. This was the lake of my boyhood dreams. Though time was pressing him upstream, Rowlands paddled ashore and brewed a pail of tea under a tall white pine that reminded him, as everything about this lake did, of a mill pond he had camped beside as a child. "I knew then," he says, "that I had found the place I had always wanted to be." To have found the place you always wanted to be, that is the secret of this book. Rowlands tells us how he happened to get to Cache Lake, but he wisely never tells us how he happened to leave. We have only MIT's word that he did. And it is the perfect glory of Cache Lake Country that reading it for the first time, or for the first time in a year, is like paddling out of the narrows onto a small open lake bordered by white pines and hemlock, moose at browse in the weed beds along one shore, a loon calling across the ripples, and pausing, like a fellow will, pausing for an entire year. In Cache Lake Country, the months pass slowly, one by one, beginning in the snows of January and ending in the snows of December, while with his two good friends, Chief Tibiash an aging Cree Indian, and Henry B. Kane, the book's illustrator, both living on nearby lakes. Rowlands guides the reader through a year in the life of the North Woods. Let me tell you what I learned from this. I learned that nature works with reason, and though its reasons are often harsh, they are just as often beneficent. In January, Rowlands writes, we generally have a thaw that reminds us of a spell of April weather, which is to make sure that the water is spread around fairly. I learned that real danger, the source of real fear, can be understated without minimizing it. If you get snow blindness when you're alone on the trail, you're in a fix and no mistake. I learned that it is delicate business comparing what is easy with what is hard. If you have common sense, Rowlands says, you don't often get into trouble, and every time you do get into trouble, you learn something about common sense the hard way. I learned that if you lived in the North Woods, you would want to be able to cook and sow and garden as well as fish and hunt and sharpen an axe. And in this book, I also had what I consider my first real contact with a culture not my own, that is, with the Cree. In Chief Tibiash, Rowlands found a sagacious North Woods tutor, and he passes along to his reader every lesson that he can. From Tibiash I learned that in most of the matters that were important to me as a boy, if only in imagination, the way you paddle a canoe, for instance, the track your footsteps make, the respect you show for game, your ability to read the real meaning of a newly bent blade of grass, a broken twig, or water slowly oozing into a hoofprint in the mud, there was no higher praise than to be taken for an Indian. The Boy Scouts had tried to teach me all of this, but Rowlands and Tibiash did it without the condescension or the treacle. As you will be able to tell at a glance from Henry Kane's illustrations, this is a work brimming with woodcraft. With patience, you can learn from its pages how to make a rabbit skin robe or an Indian drum, build an ice boat or smoke a fish, pack for a week's canoe trip or weather a blizzard in the open. But there is a catch to all this. Those two young men, Jim Rowlands and Hank Kane, not to mention Tibiash, were possessed by a demonic ingenuity. What they couldn't do with a length of quarter-inch brass pipe and a long winter can't be done. And they lived in an era of canvas and wood. Goods were shipped in barrels that could be turned into reading chairs. Friends came to fish and left behind fencing foils, which could be filed into bait rods. Theirs is a strange, old-fashioned world filled with unfamiliar things they just happened to have on hand. Substances like sugar of lead, for instance. Theirs is a place where time stretched out far enough on all sides that a man, for that is how Rowlands puts it, could turn himself to good use in just about every direction. As for women in Cache Lake Country, they come in the form of sisters and grandmothers. Wherever men boil water is how Rowlands begins some talk about the sound of tea kettles. You will not have listened to this book properly unless you mess up the house trying some of the projects Rowlands describes. Start easy. Fry up some leftover oatmeal. Sew yourself some moccasins out of an old blanket. Make a bird's Christmas tree the way Rowlands does. When summer comes and the grass is high, go out early one morning, twist a grass blade into a tiny loop, and capture a drop of dew with it. Use it as a microscope. Dig a bean hole in the backyard. Work your way up to the ice boat and the outdoor bake oven. Work your way up to a life in the woods. Everyone who reads this book will eventually wonder where Cache Lake really lies. There is only one good hint. To make a permanent magnet, you first have to poke a steel bar into the earth at an angle that matches your latitude. To make a permanent magnet at Cache Lake, you use 47 degrees. That knowledge is as close as I want to get to looking for that quiet lake with a solitary white pine on its edge and a small log cabin on a knoll. Instead, I will go on reading this book every year until the years are taken from me, grateful that by some strange quirk my father came upon it when he was 21, and decided that of all the books a man might buy in this world, this was the one he would start with. Cashlake lies before you right this minute, in Roland's beautiful, unassuming prose. If you want to search for its actual vicinity, just walk across Canada on the 47th parallel. Take this book along. You will appreciate the advice it has to offer. Verlin Klinkenborg. Foreword. It is now better than a dozen years since Cashlake Country was first published, and in that fragment of time the world has seen great changes. We have watched the dawning of the atomic age, bringing new triumphs for man, new hopes, and also new and haunting fears. But Cashlake has not changed. Serene, remote, untouched, it lives on as always, a symbol of the beauty, simplicity, and natural honesty of the northern wilderness in which it lies, the abiding place of peace and contentment. In Cashlake Country, I have recounted not only the happy and rewarding experiences of life in the north, but the deep satisfaction and excitement of discovering how inventive and resourceful man can be when his living depends upon making the most effective use of whatever comes to hand. He must learn, often with only an axe for a tool, to build himself a home. He must know where to look for and how to procure food if he is to survive, and he must learn to find his way through a world of trackless forest. There is more that he must learn, for now and then he must walk alone, trying to conquer fears that he has never known before, fear of illness, fear of death, and now and then fear of the motives of men. If the man of wilderness thinks of security at all, it is as something that lies in the future and has to be earned. He would never dream of demanding security in advance. He has no fear of failure, for he thinks of failure as one of the many steps in the business of getting ahead. Many readers of Cashlake Country have told me that its simple philosophy, our way of thinking to get the best out of life, has been helpful in easing the tensions of the hard, fast pace of modern civilization. Many, too, have discovered for themselves the satisfaction and pleasure of developing skills of the hand by working out various ideas and projects in the book. And no less pleasing has been their delight in joining the spirit on the trails and on the waterways, and in sharing the warmth of life at Cache. Cache is the woodsman's term for a safe and secure place in which to store valuable possessions, food and equipment, against the day of need. In Cashlake Country are stored the best and most treasured memories of my life, a keeping place of conviction and contentment from which I may draw when I feel the need. There is a Cashlake for everyone, but it won't be found beside a four-lane highway, nor will there be a clear trail to lead to it. If it is worth finding, it will be far from the sights and sounds of civilization, quiet and clear, and without pretension. Unless you know what to look for, you may pass it by. To my great satisfaction, Cashlake Country has lived on through the years and appears to have found its special place in the affections of readers old and young. I greet this new Wilderness edition with pleasure, and hope that it may find new readers in years to come who will share the ageless rewards and riches that I found at Cashlake in time gone by. John J. Rowlands, 1959. Portage to Contentment. On most maps, Cashlake is only a speck hidden among other blue patches big enough to have names, and unless you know where to look, you will never find it. But a place like Cashlake is seldom discovered on a map. You just come on it, that is, if you are lucky. Most men who travel the North Woods sooner or later happen on a lake or stream that somehow they cannot forget and always want to go back to. Generally, they never do go back. Cashlake lies deep in a wilderness of spruce and pine, which, except for a timber cruiser like myself and maybe a trapper now and then, few white men know. But the Indians find it good game country, and so do the big gray timber wolves that run its hills. So like many other worthwhile things, there's no easy trail to Cache Lake, for it is protected by distance, mile after forgotten mile of woods and water, and it is still clean and clear and safe from civilization. Strange it is how things work out sometimes. A man starts out for a place in mind, but before he gets there he comes on something more to his liking than he thought a spot ever could be. That's how it was with Cache Lake. I was working north through a chain of lakes and streams to look over some timber for the lumber company. I had never been in the region before, but knew in a general way where I was heading. It was in the Snow Goose Lake country, and I figured I would go up the Manitoupipagi River and make myself a camp handy to the district I had to look over. A trapper told me I would find Wobbin Lake a likely place for living. Just by way of remarking, Wobbin is Indian for east or dawn. The time was early September, which is one of the best months for traveling in the north, when the days are clear and sunny and the nights sharp with frost to make a fire feel good and remind you that fall is coming on. I stopped one night at the south end of Snow Goose Lake, where the Indians camp in the summer, and at dawn I started on. At that time of day the water is apt to be quiet, and since my canoe with outfit and supplies was riding almost to the gunwales, the smoother the water, the easier it was for me. You leave the north end of Snow Goose Lake by a narrow creek or thoroughfare, a dark and deep neck of still water with muskeg and tamarack on the west side and heavy spruce on the east where the ground rises. It was so quiet, I could hear the drops from the paddle hitting the water. The map showed that the waterway linked Snow Goose Lake with a small lake which had no name, so I didn't think much about it. Lake Wobbin was a day's paddling ahead with some tracking up the river to boot, and my mind was set on getting there as soon as I could make it. After I cleared the thoroughfare and came out on the small lake, I stopped paddling like a fellow will when he sees new water for the first time. The sun had just come up, and mist hung motionless like a big cobweb just above the surface. Ghost's breath, we called it when we were young. Over to my right, to the eastward, the shore was lined with jack pines, and in one place, close down by the water, I could see a natural clearing. On the west was part of the great swamp I had passed coming up from Snow Goose Lake, but going north on that side the land lifted and the white boles of big canoe birches showed on the slopes of a low ridge. I have seen maybe 1,000 northern lakes, and they all look alike in many ways. But there was something different about that little lake that held me hard. I sat there perhaps half an hour, like a man under a spell, just looking it over. This lake gave me the queer feeling that I had been there before. The tall pine tops were moving in the first soft breeze of morning, and as the mist drifted away, dark shadows began to edge across the water into the woods, just as they had somewhere, sometime, long ago. Then, as the sun cleared the hills and turned the still black water into shining gold, I remembered. This was the lake of my boyhood dreams. This was the lake I used to picture when I camped with my chum by a little mill pond near a meadow on a farm. We made believe it was a lake in the far northern wilderness. The cows that came down to drink were deer and moose. The dogs that barked were wolves, and the perch we caught were fighting trout. Our flat-bottomed boat was a birch-bark canoe. Then I remembered the little brook that hustled into one end of the pond, and now as I looked toward the north, I saw the froth of white water at the far end, where the Manitoupipagi comes down over a rock-spiked 40-foot pitch. This was my lake at last. Even to the black duck that came out of the shadows of a cove to fly clear against the sky and drop down on rigid wings with feet outstretched for a landing. In our mill pond it was a kingfisher. Then, for no reason that I understood, I paddled ashore, built a fire, and made myself a pail of tea. And there was the big tree, not the elm that stood by the old mill pond, but a tall white pine, just where it ought to be. I knew then I had found the place I had always wanted to be. After a while I headed on my way, but when I pulled out for the carry at the head of the lake and looked back, I knew I would one day return. The fact is, I was back in a week, and I pitched my tent in the clearing and worked out of Cache Lake on my job of cruising the timber country. The longer I stayed, the better I liked the lake, and after a while, I began thinking about giving it a name, for by then I had a feeling that it belonged to me. It could be called a lot of pleasant names, and all of them would fit, but I liked Cache because here was stored the best the North had to give. Fine timber to build a cabin and keep a man warm, fish and game and berries for food, and the kind of peace and contentment that is found only in the woods. Where you store your belongings in the North, the things you can't live without, that's a cache. I could think of no better name. Cache Lake brought me luck, for I hadn't been there long when I learned that Chief Tibiash, a Cree Indian I had known years before when my father and I came north to fish, was living on Shining Tree Lake about 2 miles from my camp. It was a meeting, I can tell you, for I had lost track of the chief when we moved to another part of the country, and many a time after I came back to the north again I had tried to get trace of him. But Indians don't leave forwarding addresses. I was young and green when I first met the chief, and in those days I thought I knew the ways of the woods. But it didn't take me long to realize that I couldn't see much more than a puppy when his eyes open. Not until I traveled the woods with the chief for several summers did I know the real meaning of a newly bent blade of grass, a broken twig, or water slowly oozing into a hoofprint in the mud. I hadn't learned to see an animal standing motionless in the woods, much less catch the quick movement at the moment of its escape. But the chief saw it all. With him, I learned to use my eyes and my nose and my ears in ways only the woods people know. Here, in the clean air of the forest, the sense of smell becomes keen, and in time you learn to detect many things, lynx and bear, moose and other animals, by their scents. Gradually the eyes learn to see and the ears to hear, for every sound in the wilderness has a meaning, be it the faint rustle of a deer mouse in dry grass, or the quavering howl of a timber wolf. Chief Tibiash is not the kind of Indian you might picture. He is small and lean, and his muscles are as tough and strong as a rawhide thong. The warm brown of dry pine spills is the color of his skin, and the many fine lines about his eyes come from years of squinting across glaring snow and ice and shining water. You might expect his eyes to be dark, but they are gray and keen. If you could summon his ancestors back, it wouldn't surprise me if you would find among the darker skins a fine-looking voyageur with gray eyes. The chief figures he is about 70 now. His mother told him that he was born in the winter of the deep snows, which could be any one of many winters up here, so he can't be sure. But his age doesn't matter, for he is faster on the trail and can last longer in a canoe than many a younger man. He still takes a 100-pound pack over a 5-mile portage without stopping to rest. It was the chief who showed me how to handle a canoe like an Indian, with the short stroke that begins at the waist and ends with a thrust from the shoulders and never tires. The proudest moment of my early years in the woods was when I was taken for an Indian because of the way I worked my paddle. I learned to live in shelters made from what came to hand in the woods, and to know and use the natural foods of the wilderness. It was the chief who helped me to make my first hunting sled and taught me to drive a dog team. I helped him tan deer and moose hides and make them into moccasins. Now I was back with him again as though there had been no space of years since I had seen Chief Tibiash. When I finished cruising the timber and started out to make my report to the company, I promised the chief I would come back some day. But right then I didn't know just when it would be. Well, when the company people got my report, they asked me how I would like to make a permanent camp on Cache Lake and keep watch over the timber country. It didn't take me more than 2 breaths to say I would take the job and be glad to have it. All I asked was that they send in tools, spikes, and tar paper roofing to build a log cabin, and supplies to keep me fit through the winter. That they did, with a large hand, including good windows for the cabin, two stoves, and plenty of pipe. The stuff came in three freight canoes, and the six young fellows that brought it stayed on to help me build the cabin, for by then it was late October and we had no time to lose before the snow came. The way those men went to work getting out logs, singing and yelling as they cut, was a caution. We used white pine for the walls and tamarack for the roof timbers. Green logs mean you must watch the chinking, for they open up as they dry. But winter was coming, and we couldn't wait for them to season, a process which takes at least 6 months. While the boys cut and placed the logs, the chief and I brought in plenty of sphagnum moss and gray clay for chinking, and in 2 weeks the cabin was closed in with the roof on. I found enough down timber that was dry to make the floor of hand-squared logs. A pretty sight it is to watch a man who knows how to use an adze square a timber almost as straight as if it was sawed. They did a fine job of fitting. The boys stayed on to cut 20 cords of firewood, for no man in his right mind faces a North Woods winter without having his wood cut and stacked. Mostly wood is cut in the winter and yarded to season until the fall, but in that way you can take your time and choose the weather. But cutting wood day by day to keep warm when the temperature drops to the bottom of the thermometer is something I don't like to think about. When the crew left, all the chief and I had to do was to finish the inside of my home and make it snug with bunks, tables, and chairs. The site I chose for my cabin is on a knoll, and from my window I can look out across the lake and over the ridge to hills far beyond. Tall jack pines lift high above my roof, and down in the marshy ground along the lake's edge to the south, fishnet willows grow side by side with alder and high-bush cranberries. One of the things that means a lot to me at Cache Lake is my spring, which lies back a little way in the woods just north of the cabin. I have always had a soft spot in my heart for springs. In a great valley I have run across a spring 40 feet wide with water bubbling up under pressure. I have even cooked eggs in a pool so hot the water would scald you. And on one occasion, I saw a spring of cold, sweet water in a hollow in the rocks on a tiny island far out in the ocean. But above all, I love the little springs that are hidden in the moist and shadowed places in the North Woods. Paths to springs are not laid out by men. They choose their own way, twisting between trees, sidestepping rocks, and skirting marshy places. So it is with the path to my spring, for roots, lightly covered by moss, lie in wait to catch your toe, and when bruised on hot summer days give off the pleasant scent of spruce or balsam sap. You walk on through a patch of sphagnum moss, soft and heavy with water, and if you look, you find the little star-shaped tufts that grow between the rocks, green on top and brown below. Everywhere, balsam and spruce seedlings, some of them only a few inches high, are fighting their way toward the sky that shows in little patches through the tops of the trees high above. But in this struggle for survival, only a few will grow up to feel the warmth of the sun. And overhead, from the dead branches, long wisps of gray moss hang like the beards of old, old men. Suddenly, from under your feet, a bird startles up into the air and is gone before you hardly have a chance to see it, although there is no mistaking the sound of a partridge. And maybe a little further on, a fool hen will lumber into the air and light on a low spruce limb, or you could knock it over if you wanted to. I have flushed hundreds of partridges in my day, but my heart always jumps when they whir off the ground. A great dead pine, blown over by winter winds years ago, lies part way into the spring. And in the dark cavern under its roots, where the soil still clings, a hole shows where a chipmunk makes its home. All about it are ferns, thin, pale fronds that reach up only a few inches, and a little way beyond, where there is too much shade for their good, are a few thin raspberry bushes. Going to my spring, you walk from open pine woods into a quiet world of green shadows and broken sunbeams, where life begins with little seedlings and ends in sodden bowl.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?